Welcome to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. My name is Fregal Byrne. Every week I speak to leading sustainability thinkers and practitioners, scientists, economists, NGOs, business leaders and investors. We discuss the sustainability imperative, the key challenges, the latest thinking, and what's working in sustainability, resilience and regeneration. I'm particularly honored today to have an opportunity to speak to James Thornton on the sustainability agenda. James is the founding CEO of Client Earth, a pathbreaking law firm that uses advocacy, litigation and research to address the greatest challenges of our time, including nature loss and climate change. Client Earth has an extraordinary record of success built on solid law and science, and has brought about fundamental change in the way environmental protections are made and enforced across Europe. So thank you very much, James, for joining me once again on the Sustainability Agenda podcast.
It's a pleasure.
Now, we spoke in, I think it was 2021, the last time we spoke, and a very interesting interview, and I'm a big fan of the work you do at Client Earth. Before we start to discuss and explore maybe a little bit where Client Earth has gone since we spoke, and your recent sabbatical and your recent book, maybe could we just set the scene a little bit? And can I ask you, I mean, we're in very difficult times on in numerous different fronts, series of interlinked challenges of all kinds, not to mention wars and political challenges. But what worries you most? You've been involved in the environmental, as an environmental activist, as a lawyer for many decades. What today is most of concern to you?
Well, honestly, it's saving civilization and whether we take the steps we need in order to save civilization. I think that's really how I think about it. Whether human beings and nature will have a good future really depends on what we do now and in the coming years. And, you know, I've just been meeting with people, a series of people from different countries and scientists talking about climate change in particular, but there's also nature loss. And the scientists are more and more worried. I mean, I've been, as you say, working at this for many decades, but it's more pressing with every passing year. And the scientists keep doing very good research around the world, from, you know, from Europe to America to Asia to Antarctica, everywhere. And the news that comes back is always the same, which is things are progressing in the wrong direction, and we need to move. So what concerns me most is, as we learn more and more, are we prepared to act? And you see around the world, Britain actually appears today in the election that's happening to be moving in a progressive direction, where the government that we think is going to be the new government actually does care about doing something about climate change. In much of Europe and in the United States, we see movement towards nationalistic governments. In Asia is also a bright spot. Maybe we can talk about that. The Chinese are extremely eager to address climate change. So it's a mixed picture what countries around the world are doing in order to address this. But my concern is, as we know more and we know that things are getting more critical, are we doing enough? Will we do enough?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Can you tell us a little bit about Client Earth, what you do, what motivated you to set up Client Earth, and also maybe a little bit about the structure, because you engage in advocacy work and legal work, and you have some kind of hybrid structure, and what motivated you to take that approach?
Sure. Great question. And so I started doing environmental legal work, you know, lawyer for the planet type of legal work in the United States during the Reagan administration a while ago, and learned how to use law in that case, at the very beginning, it was to stop water pollution and air pollution, things that were of great concern, and save forests and so on. And then I moved to the, about 22 years ago, to the UK, for love, you know. I and my now husband wasn't able to live in the United States, so I came this way. And I thought, well, these are powerful tools, these legal tools that we can use, and I'll start working with one of the big environmental groups in Europe because they're so sophisticated. What I found was they were very sophisticated in the UK and Europe when it came to advocacy, but that there were virtually no lawyers involved in the environmental movement in Europe and in the UK. And I knew from my experience that if you put together very highly skilled legal work with advocacy, it's a much more powerful way of addressing these problems than one or the other on their own. So I set up Client Earth. And the idea is that the Earth is the client and everyone who lives on her. So everyone listening is the client of Client Earth, as well as the natural systems being the client. And we have grown now to about 300 people. And the goal was to start in Europe, but to set up a global law firm for the environment as a charity. And the idea is, since the Earth is the client, it's a charity, and I go out and raise money to do the work. These 300 people, about 190 of them are lawyers. And their lawyers now come from over 30 countries. And we have offices in London and Brussels, Madrid, Berlin, Warsaw. And then in Asia, we have an office in Beijing for almost 10 years now, a new office in Tokyo. We have people in Singapore and another brand new office in California. So it's really and we work in other countries, but those are where the offices are. And so it's really kind of a global legal brain and a set of people using all of the tools of law. And we work with NGOs around the world. So we have now memoranda of understanding, so meaning deep partnerships with over 300 NGOs. So we combine skills, and sometimes we do advocacy on our own, as you were mentioning. So in Brussels, for example, where the European laws are written, we have lawyers that are helping to write those laws so that the advocacy working with other groups that we do is, okay, how do you turn these ideas into laws which are enforceable? And then how do you enforce them? So we get involved in writing laws and then in enforcing laws. Which again is a very powerful combination.
Yeah, very, very interesting indeed. And can you maybe just share one or two highlights, cases that you've recently taken on, had some success with? Give listeners a sense of what's at stake in some of these cases.
Sure. Well, I'll give you an example in Europe and then in the US. Brand new case, and then an example of what's going on in China as well. So we've started to bring a series of cases against companies in Europe and the UK who are greenwashing. Several years ago, we started a whole department of lawyers within our organization who we drew from the top corporate law firms. So they were experts in using corporate law, but they switched sides. Often the way they describe the shift is, I left the dark side to come over to the light side. But they're very skillful, and they really know the inside of how these legal systems work, whether it's securities law, bankruptcy law, fraud, and so on. So very skillful. And we've brought some successful cases on greenwashing against some of the biggest companies in Europe. So against KLM Airlines, for example, it was the first climate case against an airline in the world. And we caught them lying to everyone, saying, fly as much as you want. We have a beautiful offset program. The more you fly, you know, the better it is for the climate. Come join us, is essentially the message they were giving, you know. That's what they were trying to convey, you know.
And very, very seductive.
Yeah. I felt like, why not have more holidays, you know? But when you analyzed it, not surprisingly, you know, it was a greenwash. So we sued them and we won. A court gave it to us. And then we've recently, with French groups, sued Total Energy, which is the largest fossil fuel company in France. And its emissions globally are bigger than the emissions of the whole country of France. So it's a big player. They were greenwashing as well, and there again, victory. So one of the things you're trying to do, as in these cases, as we go forward, is just to get companies to behave. You know, companies need to improve, but if you don't make them tell the truth, they can get away with murder. Well, essentially, legally, really murder, I think. But so that's one type of case, and that's been quite successful in Europe. In the United States, we've just brought a case against the oil and gas interests in Colorado. And there's this thing that goes on in America. Well, it's global, actually, but we're tackling it first in the United States, where oil and gas companies, who are the major emitters of carbon globally throughout all of history, so you need to do something about it, they are given the right to drill an oil or gas well. And that comes with an obligation at the end of the life of the well to properly seal it up. Now, properly sealing it up costs money and is very important, because if you properly seal it up, then it's not going to leak toxic pollutants into the atmosphere locally and into the water for the people around there. And it won't leak methane, which is an extremely bad gas, for natural gas, for has this quality of being even worse than carbon dioxide for the planet. So they don't do it, though. So you have all of these oil companies, and they do this game, which is, so they get the right, they get all kinds of subsidies to drill, they make all the money from the oil and gas, and then when it comes to the obligation to close the well, they sell it to another company, which sells it to another company, which sells it to a company which is designed to go bankrupt, which means that the taxpayers eventually have to pay for closing all these wells. And it's criminal. And so we've brought a case to begin to address this. And it's a widespread activity. So it's in the US, but it's also elsewhere. And if we can start forcing the companies to simply be responsible, to do what the law requires them to do, it also changes the dynamics of their business, because economists are saying that it's up to somewhere around $3 trillion in the United States in costs that they've avoided. You know, imagine that. Wouldn't you like to be able to declare bankruptcy and, you know, pocket $3 trillion extra? I mean, why not?
In a previous conversation with Katharina Pistor, author of The Code of Capital, we discussed how corporations use their legal power to shape laws in their favor. How do you think we can create a balance that ensures environmental issues are fairly addressed?
Sure. So it's certainly true that corporations use very high paid lawyers to try and get their way when it comes to what goes into laws, and then in avoiding responsibility often. That's exactly why you need equally good lawyers on the side of the environment. Because if you have the companies with the world's best lawyers trying to get things their way, and on the side of the environment, you have only great people who are campaigning, then you don't have equal guns on both sides. So you really need top lawyers, some of the world's top lawyers, on the side of the environment as well. And that's why I set up Client Earth. One of my first meetings was with the man who was then the head of the Environment Committee in Brussels, in the Parliament. And I met with him, and I explained what I wanted to do. This was very early, when I only had a couple of people with me. And I said, you know, I want to be able to come and help you. I know you're a very progressive lawmaker, and I want to help you be able to write good laws. And then we're going to go off and we're going to enforce these laws in England, which was then part of the EU, France, Germany, and so on. And he said, this is so great. Let me tell you why. He said, we at the European Union, in the Parliament, have very little legal capacity. I'm not a lawyer. The parliamentarians aren't lawyers. And we have almost no legal capacity. So what happens is, we have the ambition of doing a nice green law on whatever it may be. And then the companies, and we have a draft, you know, looks pretty decent. And then companies come in, and he said, I'll give you BMW as an example, because they came in last week. And they came in with five highly paid lawyers, and they gave me a thick set of amendments to the law, and they explained why it was good for the world, good for Europe, and good for BMW. And they had all of this prepared. Then I met with some environmentalists, and they said, what you really need to do is to make sure the law does the best for the environment. And he said, well, it didn't go much beyond that. They had some general principles. He said, my problem is, as a lawmaker, if you have somebody coming in with hundreds of pages of detailed amendments to the law, and then a campaigning group who says, please make sure you do the right thing, it's very unequal. So if you have lawyers working with the NGOs, as we do, it levels the playing field. And then you have equal arms on both sides, and we generally win. And we generally win because you pick your battles, you pick the highest strategic leverage that you can get. And in terms of writing laws, then you work with the progressive people in the parliament. They want to make something that often in Europe, it has been the case. It's been a very good 20 years or so for passing environmental legislation. They want to do the right thing and they want to make sure it's effective. And the whole group of NGOs and citizens in Europe gives them the juice to get the legislation through. And then we make sure that it's written in such a way that the companies are actually bound to it, or the governments.
How does that work, James?
It really depends on what people demand. So if Europeans or people in the UK or Americans really demand it, then legislatures will respond. And then you can get laws that actually address these things. Companies will always fight it. Companies have fought environmental legislation from the very, very beginning. From the 60s when all of this started, they fought tooth and nail every inch of the way. And nevertheless, very, very good laws have been passed. And they will keep fighting because they don't want to spend an extra penny. They just don't. I mean, the companies are set up to earn profits, and anything that gets in the way of that tends to be something they don't want to do. Now, there are some companies who are actually smart enough to see that the future requires them to be green. You have, I mean, China as a country doing that, but you also have you have lots of companies who are now saying, okay, if I invest in green technology, I'll be ahead of the pack. If I produce electric vehicles, I'll be ahead of the game. So some companies see correctly their own financial interest in doing the right thing for the environment. But Exxon will never stop doing what it does. Exxon will never slow down, its attack on environmental regulation. And there are a bunch of companies like that, which is why you need to make sure that the laws are good and that somebody then enforces them. People in the EU weren't bringing environmental cases when I started. It was very rare for NGOs to actually sue. And now, from climate cases to other cases, there are hundreds of cases going on. And you need to do that. You need to hold the companies to account. And otherwise, relying on their good intentions occasionally works. It generally doesn't work.
Yeah, and governments.
Yes. So, for example, we sued the UK government twice over climate change, and we beat them twice. The outgoing government was very reluctant, even when the court ordered them to comply with their own law, to do anything about it. In fact, they were moving in the wrong direction. Very hopeful that the new government coming in, which will be headed by somebody who used to be a barrister, will understand the legal obligations and embrace them and even celebrate them. And where the UK could go back to being a leading country, which it has fallen back from being, but it could, and its law requires it to do good things. But yes, even the government, sadly, was uninterested in complying with the laws that it had written for itself. A lot of these, I don't think they expected to have to comply with it. I don't think they thought anyone was going to hold them to account.
Can we talk about the US for a moment, James? In the US, the Supreme Court has tremendous influence. Recently, the court limited the authority of federal agencies to interpret laws, if I understand that correctly. How do you think that change might affect environmental regulations and other areas of government in the United States?
So in the United States, the Supreme Court as you may know, got stacked with, I'm sure you do know, got stacked with conservative judges by Trump in his first and hopefully only administration. So they've been making a series of radically conservative moves. So they overturned Roe against Wade, the abortion decision that gave women the right to control their own bodies. They've just decided that a president is immune from prosecution for most criminal acts that he commits while a president, making him a king essentially. And that's not a hysterical reading of the case. That is what they did. So if they're doing that to, human civil rights, and they're doing that to boost the powers of a potential demagogue as president, it's not surprising they're also attacking environmental laws. And there was a case, just recently called Chevron against NRDC. I used to work at NRDC. Chevron against NRDC, in which what the Supreme Court said was, for the last many decades, really since the Second World War, the United States has relied on expert agencies, the Securities and Exchange Commission, the Food and Drug Administration, the Environmental Protection Agency. So Congress writes laws, they're quite complicated, and then you need an expert agency who says, okay, now we're going to write a regulation. It would be a tax regulation as well, that tells you in detail how to apply this in the real world. And then somebody doesn't like it, like Chevron, and then they sue. And in court, the doctrine had been that if the administrative agency, which spent years writing the law, or the regulation rather, and Chevron say disagree about something, we presume, we give a presumption, we put our finger on the scale a bit for the agency because they're the expert and they've had years of writing this regulation, and Chevron and everybody else has had input into the regulation. Now, that was a pretty sensible way to do things, as far as I'm concerned. And what the Supreme Court said was, no longer will we give any presumption to the expert agency. Now, if Chevron or, Mr. Smith challenges, then we'll say, well, the agency interpretation means no more to us than Mr. Smith's or Chevron's. So that, yes, will lead already. People are talking about Chevron and others, Exxon and so on, lining up hundreds of lawsuits to challenge regulations they don't like that that they were bound by before. So you have a period in America of chaos when it comes to environmental law, but not just environmental law. We'll see what goes on with the election, but the rule of law itself is really being challenged in the United States, and environmental law, is certainly part of that.
Yeah, not good, not good. Now, you've led Client Earth for 17, 18 years, overseeing expansion, China, Southeast Asia. How has this journey, James, shaped your understanding of sustainability, both for the environment and for activists themselves? Maybe give us some sense of that journey and how you came to write your latest book, Nature, My Teacher.
Sure. Well, the journey, as I mentioned, was part of it earlier, was simply to take my skills that I'd learned in one jurisdiction in the United States into what turned out pretty quickly to be 28 countries in the EU. And that was a journey of discovery for me. So I became a lawyer in the UK early on because I thought I had to be a member of one legal system in the European domain if I was going to do my work. That was an interesting journey. And then I learned really the different legal cultures and more generally the difference in cultures from the West in the UK all the way up to Poland, where we also I set up an office as one of the first offices. The legal system's quite different. The social system's quite different, but the need to be there with coherent regulation on the environment, very, very much the same. But I learned to be adaptable and fluid to get through high leverage legal ambitions, whether it's writing laws or bringing cases. And the way I did that was to find people who I thought were excellent informants, people who were both very knowledgeable and were committed to doing something for society and for the environment, and were people I could trust as human beings. So that was the search. And then I went into deep dialogue with them. And we formulated ways of addressing these problems in the different countries and the different legal systems and in the European system. And then when it came to China, I was invited to meet some Chinese officials in Brussels. And then they invited me back to Beijing. This is almost 10 years ago. And the mission in Beijing was, please come and talk to us about how we should write a law. And these were members of the Supreme Court and the head of the Environment Committee in the People's Congress, you know, the parliament there, and the number two person at their environment agency that I met with. And they said, come give us a seminar on how to write a law that will allow Chinese NGOs, citizen groups, to bring cases to enforce environmental law. Because we've got pretty good environmental law, true, but citizens can't enforce it. And we want them to start enforcing it. So I was amazed by this. I got there and I gave them the seminar, of course. And they said, we want you to do this for us, with us, because you've done this work on two continents, in Europe and in the United States. So you must know what a legal system should look like if it's going to be accessible to citizens to enforce the law. And so at the beginning of the seminar, what I said was, well, this is great. And of course, I'm very happy to help. But I just want to praise you for doing this. I mean, certainly as somebody who's only seen China from the West, allowing Chinese citizens to sue companies, including those owned by the government, is revolutionary, you know? And the senior Supreme Court judge said, Mr. Thornton, I need to stop you right there. Revolutionary is a big word in Beijing. And I thought, okay, we're two human beings on opposite sides of a table. This is terrific. So it began there, and I helped them write the law. And then one thing led to another, and they asked me to train Chinese judges in how to decide environmental cases, including those on the Supreme, starting with the Supreme Court. So I brought in other experts from around the world. We did that. And then they said, you know, could members of the Supreme Court said, could you set up an office in Beijing? Because we could so much use this international help and guidance and training. So we did that. And now we have, well, more than 15 people in Beijing. And they work by an eye visit. I'm going in October again, and I'm a member of a committee advising the Politburo on how to improve environmental regulation, which amazes me that they would do that. They one of the things that I was surprised in the very first meeting was that, you know, in the West we have this idea that you know, China is you know, a dictatorship, and Chinese are robots controlled by Xi Jinping. And wow, did I find out that was not true. And when I got there, and there's a great deal of discussion and debate, and you have some of the smartest minds in the country, deeply dedicated to moving the country as far and as fast as they can when it comes to the environment. Because unlike some American politicians, people running the country absolutely get that they need to change quickly if they're going to have a good future. And they talked about that in the first meeting. They said, our job is to make sure that Chinese people are healthy here in 2,000 years. That's our perspective, because we've been here for 2,000 years, and they will not be unless we solve the climate problem. And I thought, wow, you know, that really does give me hope. I mean, if, first of all, in Europe and America, I don't get to sit in a room and chat with Supreme Court judges about how to improve. And I told them that. I said, look, I'm also really happy to be here in the first meeting, because you know, in the West I have to sue somebody in order to get to talk to the Supreme Court. But
It's
there, You know, this openness, you know, they're saying, great, how do you do this? And that seems to be the general way they do things, that we recognize there's a problem and we want to find not just me, but we want to find best people in the world who can help us figure out how to solve it as fast as possible.
China has been making huge advancements in sustainability, investing in green innovation, transforming industries such as electric vehicles, solar energy, amongst many others. What lessons do you think the West can learn from China's approach?
And it's not by accident. I mean, they're very aware that they need to come up with a different way of living. And in that, they have a very coherent way of thinking about it, which we don't in the West, at a governmental level, certainly. I mean, you have smart people in NGOs and think tanks and universities, but as a at a government level, they've taken on what they call building an ecological civilization. And they put in their constitution in 2018 that all of the efforts of the government must be directed towards building an ecological civilization. So that means redoing agriculture, so it's friendly, redoing manufacturing, so it's friendly, energy systems, transport. They're also looking, and I was on a committee to help examine the legal system to make sure it could deliver ecological civilization. They're also looking at economics and how to revise economics so that economic decisions come out in favor of things that are good to build ecological civilization. It's really impressive. The Economist had a big article last week on a front page article on Chinese science. And it turns out that in the last generation, the Chinese, by their measures, you know, a measure that was pretty much one anyone would accept, the Chinese in one generation have moved from being way behind in research to leading in something like 6 out of the 10 categories of science that they looked at. And as I analyzed it, these were all categories of science that you need to invest in a major way to have the sort of breakthroughs you mentioned, fusion, to have the sort of breakthroughs you need in order to build a green future. And so it's not accidental that they're having these breakthroughs. They've set out the template, you know, and then they're following it. And what I would like to see is a virtuous competition, you know, instead of, and tariffs could be part of it, I guess, if you need to shield your companies in the West in order to get up and going. But what we really need is a virtuous competition to see who can be greener faster and who can actually sell the greenest stuff to the most people in the world. And that's not the way things are going. You know, they're doing it, and you know, in the West, we're only beginning to sort of do it. You know, we're doing it reluctantly, but there should be, if there could be the right kind of competition, then you really get things igniting, and then sure, we can save civilization. I don't doubt that.
This question that I guess I hinted at earlier, in terms of your understanding of personal sustainability, as it were, for an activist. I realize I did an interview just prior to the interview I did with you in 2021 after COP26 with some of the activists, young activists, very, very inspiring, but also really harrowing as well, hearing the sacrifices they made, the anxieties they had, the price they were paying. And I think that's something that we don't often look at enough, really. This question of balancing and finding inner resources, paying attention to yourself, your own development, and your own needs somehow. This, in many ways, seems to be a key theme in your book.
Absolutely. You know, it's very hard work, the work of being an activist. You are inspired by the vision of taking care of everyone, taking care of the planet, taking care of people, and taking care of nature. And you're inspired by the love of nature and people. And that's a very profound inspiration and makes you very strong. And so a group of activists doesn't need to be as large as the people they're opposing in order to have a great impact. But it is hard work. It takes a lot of energy. And, you know, I burned out twice, really. I mean, once in my 20s after I set up an organization in the US. And I was really exhausted when I took this sabbatical and read this book. after almost 2 decades of working on setting up Planet Earth and really making it work, coming up with a strategy, finding people to work with, working with them, going raising the money, and remaining hopeful. Now, the hope is something that you ground in meeting with people, as with the Chinese, as with young people. You see the possibilities, and you know we can do the right thing. You ground hope in knowledge, and it's not a lazy hope that activists have. So, I mean, hope can be lazy. You know, I really hope the weather's good tomorrow, and as I sit in my armchair, you know, I really hope that somebody's going to solve this climate change problem while I'm sitting by the pool drinking a Tom Collins, you know, and that sort of hope doesn't change the world, and that's not how activists are. So you motivate yourself and you do it again and again, and it's easy to burn out. So where do you go to refresh yourself? I did a study on this many years ago. You know, I set up an organization. I'm a Zen priest, by the way, and I set up an organization to help activists learn how to meditate, to renew themselves. And that was based on a study I did. I talked to 100 activists and said, where does your motivation come from? And every single one, and I did deep interviews, a couple of hours worth of interviews. They were fascinating. But the ultimate source that every single one of these people told me was anger. My ultimate source of motivation is anger. And I would say, well, I understand that, and anger can be a good source of energy and a good motor. But if you rely exclusively on the energy of anger, you know, where are you going to come up with positive solutions? And why won't you burn out? Where do you go to not burn out? And one of them said, well, I go to my family. And I said, well, I get that. But if you go to your family angry, that's one thing. Wouldn't it be nicer for your family if you went having learned a way to deal with your anger? And he said, oh, well, actually, probably would be a lot nicer for them, you know? So I, at that point, was teaching activists how to meditate, and I started a kind of movement. I helped start a movement, at least in America, where activists learned how to meditate in order to give them the space from which they could go and acknowledge the anger, feel it, and go beyond it into positive place where they could look for positive solutions, because the angry mind really doesn't allow you to find positive solutions, and that's what we need. But even so, and even with all my years of meditation and being a Zen priest, you know, doing it day in, day out for the 18 years or so I did before taking the sabbatical, is just very wearing. And I hadn't realized how wearing it was until I did take the sabbatical. And then, as I write about it in the book, a lot of anxiety that was bottled up in me, once I stopped and relaxed, came out, and then I had to deal with it. And so the book deals very honestly with climate anxiety and anxiety for the future. And I was taking the sabbatical just after I stepped down from being CEO. I'm now the president and founder of Planet Earth, but I don't run it on a day-to-day basis. I do other things. And it was interesting. I found that I was very comfortable in writing about climate anxiety and anxiety in general once I was no longer CEO, and that it would be valuable perhaps to share those feelings, because I didn't feel comfortable. I thought I had to keep the flag up, and I'm not sure I actually did, but that's how I felt. So I didn't feel like I could honestly share those anxieties while I was the CEO, the founding CEO, but I do now. And my thought was, in sharing them and sharing ways to cope, it might help others. You know, if we all understand that the anxiety is a rational response, climate anxiety is a rational response to what's going on. It's not your fault feeling anxious. You're right to feel anxious. It makes perfect sense. And then how do you deal with it? So the book is largely about that.
The title of your book is Nature, My Teacher. We have many ways of looking at nature, relating to nature, and not all of them conscious, indeed. What is it about nature as a teacher that inspires you?
Nature is endlessly fascinating to me, and I think that started very young. And you were talking about young people earlier. I think every young person who has any exposure to nature is immediately fascinated by it. We have this very deep and abiding attraction to the living world and fascination with it, which tends to get lost as people, as we become adults. But it never stopped for me. I simply get absorbed in nature very easily. I need to spend time in the natural world. I'm happiest when I do. And of course, I'm not alone in that. Many people feel the same. And what is it about it? Well, I don't, it's hard to put in words, as you say, because a lot of it is unconscious. We are nature is one way to think about it. We tend to feel separate from nature, but we're not, so if you think of every breath you take, that's been through plants. It's circled around the world. It has touched many living things. Living things give you the breath you take. Living things obviously give you the food that you eat. Sunlight is transformed into the food that keeps you alive by plants. How grateful one feels to plants when you think about that. I had a meditation retreat and one up in the mountains, and I had just seen some bees. And for a whole sitting in that meditation, I investigated in my mind what I knew about how bees make honey and how many thousands of trips it took to make a tablespoon of honey. And I was simply overwhelmed by the gratitude that I felt to the bees. And that's an appropriate feeling, I think. And it's one that one can always touch into if you get quiet. In the same meditation retreat, I thought, well, there's an ancient Buddhist story about a Buddha, the Buddha of compassion, as he was leaving life as he was dying. And the story was he was going to be going on into perfect nirvana and never coming back. And as he was dying, he heard the cry of a rabbit that was being killed. And he immediately said, "I'm going back. I need to help." And that immediate compassion for living things sprung spontaneously is what all of us feel, really. And so I thought, well, let me investigate the sound of the living world helped this master. What happens if I'm sitting up in the mountains, which I was doing, and I just listen? So I just listened. And it was from before dawn till the end of the day. And I just listened, and the whole world opened up for me, So I heard the silence of pre-dawn, very silent, and then a few birds calling as dawn comes up, and then other birds, and it becomes a real chorus. And then, as the heat came up in the mountains, the insects came up. So you had this whole orchestra of communication within species and between species that I was ordinarily not paying attention to. And I thought, well, here it is. All I need to do is to be quiet and to pay attention. And I'm deeply informed by this. So these are experiences of nature being a teacher, but it's more than that. These experiences are very important, but it's the sense of not being separate from it. Of being part of it, and as part of it, defending my own life by saving as much of the natural world and of other people as I can. So it's very helpful if you're an activist and you're looking to sustain yourself, to realize that it's not just an abstract idea of saving the planet, but to have a very deep, visceral, emotional and mental understanding that the natural world is you, and that by you acting on its behalf, you're acting on your own behalf, and there's no difference at all. And that you must, if you're going to have a good, rich, full life as a human being, feel that connection to nature and explore it and support nature in order to support yourself, your family, your friends.
That's very, very eloquent, James. In Zen Buddhism, many of the teachings, many of the stories make the connection between ourselves and nature. How has that been for you as a Zen Buddhist practitioner?
Yeah, well, I mean, on the simplest level, I guess, the idea of being a Buddhist, you at a certain point, if you get serious, you take a vow. You mentioned the Bodhisattva vow. Bodhisattva is somebody who wants to help, really. And the Bodhisattva vow is, I will save all sentient beings. Now, that sounds very grandiose, but being a lawyer, I'm also a practical guy. So when I take, the vow to save all sentient beings is exactly what I do as an environmental lawyer. So I'm trying to save all sentient beings, all people, all animals, all plants, by protecting the environment. It's really very straightforward for me. Saving all sentient beings is, for me, being an environmental lawyer. So there's no separation between, the detailed work that you do with statutes and lawsuits and all that, and the vow. There are lots of wonderful stories in the tradition that are connected with nature. And some of the famous people in the men and women in the tradition are ones that went off into nature in order to deepen their experience, and that's very helpful. Then for me, though, having done that, I always want to come back to the marketplace, as they say. So they have this idea, and that they even talk about that. One of the famous Buddhist Zen, particularly, illustrations of your progress and understanding yourself is called the ox herding pictures. And the idea is, there's an ox herder and then the ox. And the ox is, you are the ox herder and you are the ox, this unruly, big, clumsy animal. And in over the course of a number of episodes, you learn how to tame the ox, and the ox starts doing good things, and the ox becomes less irritable and less unruly, and becomes more helpful. And then in the very end is riding the ox into the marketplace in order to be helpful, and the ox, instead of going into the China store and breaking everything, is simply skillful and helpful. So that's one nice animal thing.
Yes.
I met an old friend who's a Zen master when I was in LA, and he said, I love what you're doing with Klein Earth and saving the environment, and I have to say, you really are trying to fulfill that vow of saving all beings. But he said, let's be honest, you're not going to save everyone. And I said, of course not. And there are forest fires. Climate change is happening. The question is how much we can save. And he said, yeah, that's right. And you're doing the right thing. And it reminds me of an old story where, there's a dove who sees there's a forest fire. And what can a dove do about a forest fire? Well, there's a lake over there. So the dove goes over to the lake and it wets its wings and it comes back and it puts a few drops on the forest fire and it goes back to the lake and it keeps doing this. And I thought, well, this is a pretty good story, and he said, the dove keeps doing this until, of course, the dove gets tired and burns and falls into the fire. And I thought, wow, that's a heck of a story. that really encourages me.
Yes. Yes.
And there is some of it. I mean, but that's part of the burnout thing as well. You have to acknowledge that as great as my ambition is to prevent anyone from facing any harm, there will be harm. So, and I will die one day. And the book talks a lot about getting older and dying after trying hard. And that's all part of it too, you know. But you know, of course you'll die. And you know, human species will eventually die. I went through a long time thinking about that, and it's actually quite comforting to realize that even if we really screw up with climate change, that we won't take down the rest of nature. Life will survive. We might screw ourselves very badly, but life will survive. And then the question is how to screw ourselves less badly. And that's really what the game is. And it's a game very worth playing, you know. And to understand that the anxiety you feel is a reasonable response is very helpful, because then that you say, okay, now how do I deal with it? And how do I refresh myself? For example, by going to nature, by being quiet, by meditating for me. And then I get the juice to go on again. And I make new discoveries every day, as everyone does, you know, about how to comport myself in the world that I currently find it on that day in order to try and achieve part of this mission.
That's a great vision, James. Very, very inspiring. Cover such wide territory here in the book. It's very personal memory, great stories, full of philosophical questions, spiritual questions, pragmatic questions. I'm just wondering whether you could read some sections from the book, James.
Sure. Well, here's one that just pops up. This would be a piece about being in nature, and we were talking about listening. So here's a short one. And the thing about the book is it's written to be a book of short essays, and then in 12 sections, and each of those sections closes with a short poem. I was beginning to write this as poetry, and I've published several books of poetry, but I thought, well, that's actually, it'll be much more accessible if I do it as short essays, and that's why I did it in this form. But they tend to be short, and hopefully pithy and nicely written. And this one is from the time I had in South Africa, where we went into quite a remote place that was being rewilded, just in order to be with nature, and it was super refreshing. So this one is called Listening to Friends. I'm on my balcony in the Finbos, practicing unapologetic rest, when a cricket's song suggests I listen to my friends. A bird pipes up who sings behind a wall. It's a southern boo-boo, a kind of bush shrike. I listen for half an hour. She dialogues with herself by turns, gleeful, squawky, kvetchy, doubtful, chortling, angry, and tuneful. A soliloquy on her week, nattered in a low voice, no one else to hear. When her song ends, its absence gives me the mountain's silence.
Thank you.
Here's one about being angry and being, it gets you into kind of some of the anxiety. It's called Do Something. A slow crimping happens when the morning sound you hear is motorcycle, not dawn chorus. When diesel engines hound you as you walk and your lungs can't get fresh air. When planes drone over as you dodge hot fumes from buses. When you reach out through the noise and by a constructive act of imagination, recall clear wind singing on the mountain and stars rising over the horned owl call. There's a growing urgency in the loss, knowing we are raking our planet clean of life, a deepening sadness from knowing the details of the dying. The species cut, the forest cut, the reef bleached. The songs of all the things that sing are being silenced. They jammed the music of our evolution and will guide it no more. As a loved one lays dying, the wonder of life is clear. Trivia like ego and entertainment and the social whirl fall away as a loved one lies dying. It's like that with the dwindling of the living world. The depth of sadness is a measure of love. The loss accretes. It is real and speeding. Everything, every day brings it to me. This loss is the canvas on which everything happens. The sadness and background to all other feeling. Help me do something about it. Don't try to jolly me.
Wow, thank you.
This is called Biggest Risk. At a climate conference, a government official came to me and said, I have something urgent to tell you, but I must say it quietly. Quietly, he said, politicians who deny climate change, like many Republicans in the US, and leaders who do nothing, like the UK Prime Minister, are security risks. Let me underline that. Security risks. These people will collapse civilization in a few decades through stupidity and inaction. Forget terrorism. These people are cementing the foundations of a global genocide. Why do I say genocide rather than tragedy? Because they could prevent it. They occupy the positions of responsibility and are letting it happen. It's on their hands. I listened, and he added, I have to say this quietly given my position. I can't say out loud that our leaders are our biggest security risk. Now it's up to you. Go out and amplify this message. We have to replace them with people who take climate seriously. It's not too late, but it's almost too late. Upon reflection, I can only agree. Now, how to amplify this message?
Thank you.
And then just this one's the very last thing in the book, and I love it. And this is one of those connecting with nature ones. This is a short poem called Octopus and Me. The octopus is dreaming, twitches and rapid eye movements. What is the octopus dreaming of? Crabs and fish. What am I dreaming of? Oceans unharmed. Octopus and me. Different pillows, same dream.
Thank you.
Sure, thank you.
An earlier piece you read just prompted this question, this idea about right action. I think maybe it was this chap coming over to you and worried about the security risk and so forth. The kinds of solutions that we need, which are, you know, come from communities and people and groups, which take time. They take time to share ideas, share a vision, to learn to work together. Many of the solutions that we are presented with are very top down. They're very coming from large organizations and so forth. I'm just wondering if you have any reflections on that.
Sure. Well, I think it needs to be bottom up and top down. The only way that you can move governments and companies into the right lane of action quickly enough is certainly by having regulation, and countries need to agree to act mutually in that way. So there needs to be top down work and then bottom up work. And you're talking about communities. Absolutely. People need to feel like they have a place in this, and they do. Everyone has activities that they can undertake, whether it's farmers or kids going to school, running a small business, running a big business. Everybody has a role to play. And the way that you don't just move into lazy hope, like I was talking about earlier, is by empowering yourself to say, okay, I can do this, which certainly must include voting and certainly must include demanding the right action from governments, but also one's own action and being creative. I mean, I keep reading in the UK, for example, just over the last week, about all kinds of interesting rewilding projects that I hadn't heard of before. And they go from very small scale to lots of people collaborating to create wildlife corridors, for example, to a farmer that I just heard about yesterday who gave up wheat farming because the soil is getting worse and worse and worse and rewilded and is actually making more money. So you have this whole myriad of ways in which the ecosystem of people and their activities and their interests and their creativity and joy in doing something need to be a focus for all of us. And then it needs to be top down too. And if both happen, then we find our place, we feel empowered, and we make the change we need.
Wow, it's a great vision, James. Thank you so much for your time today and for sharing your inspiration, your hard-won experience, and your philosophy and insights. And I wish you all the very best.
Thank you. A great pleasure to talk to you again.
Thank you for listening to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. I hope you found it interesting. It would be great if you could leave a review and share the podcast on social media. You can sign up at iTunes to make sure you don't miss any future episodes.